This is Shush with the Apache Nation. You are listening to Light on Conspiracies.
Welcome back to Light on Conspiracies, the second part for subscribers only.
I'm here with my beautiful friend Jytte Fredholm Ferreira, and in this second hour I want to explore more how she deals with fear, limitations, and so on, and how she does to actually reach her goals and her dreams and how they change over time. So welcome back, and please tell us a little bit more about your family. It's an extraordinary family, I think. So if you can please tell us a bit about that.
Right. Yes, I do have a very extraordinary family. I have a very brave and wild husband, and I have three absolutely incredible sons that have grown up to young men now that I'm very, very proud of. They have strong spirits. They are brave. They're unafraid. They will take on the world from their own hearts and passion, and I'm very happy that we've been able to lead them into a path where they will really follow their passion in life. And that's what you want for your kids. You know, you want them to not do what other people want them to, but to do what they really want and to stand up for what they believe without fear.
It's really funny because, I mean, the way I see these three individuals are young warriors that are standing in their truth, in their balance, very different. I mean, one is totally focused on surfing. Another one is really into fishing. And the third one, I don't know so much about your youngest son, but I find it very liberating to see that these individuals have been left to develop into themselves instead of trying to put them into some square box that would fit into the machine.
Mm-hmm.
I know also that you have done some homeschooling, that they're doing homeschooling at the moment, that you take them out of the normal school system. And this is something that is something we have done as well with our daughter, and something that is very important for many people, but they're not allowed to in Sweden. It's totally illegal. And some people are even almost fleeing Sweden to be able to get sort of in charge of how they want their child to develop.
Mm.
When you took your kids out of school, how was that nervous, or were you relaxed in that decision?
Actually, yeah, I was nervous. I was very nervous. I would say that, you know, I would probably never have taken my kids out of conventional school had it not been because we were going to go sailing around the world for 3 years and I had no option. And I think the sailing bit and buying a new boat and leaving our lives behind was a very small and easy part in comparison to taking the kids out of school, because I felt that, well, now I'm responsible for my kids' education and future, because we put so much trust into the school system and we don't know if we are really capable of handling this. And it seems like a big thing, and my kids were all going into high school, and it was a big step for me, very big step. And it obviously took a lot of investigation, a lot of research, and speaking to other people that had done it, etc., to realize that this is very doable and the results can be absolutely incredible if you do it right. And like I said, we had no option. So we took them out and they started on these various homeschooling programs. And it's very tough for the kids. It requires a lot of self-discipline, which is great because it teaches them self-discipline for the future. It teaches them that nothing will happen unless you actually do it, because nobody can do this for you. And you can't go from step one to step two unless you actually completed step one properly, which is homeschooling teaches you in a very good way. And unfortunately, in normal school, you can still tag along even if you failed all your subjects, more or less. You'll still be pushed on to the next level. And you leave school without knowledge sometimes, which is really sad. This won't happen in a homeschooling system. It worked really well during the sailing years, and when we came back from the sailing back to Africa, it wasn't really an option to put them back into school, because they had to finish what they were doing on the course that they were, and they chose to do so as well, because they now also realized the amount of freedom that it allows you to have doing homeschooling. You do school from 8 to 1 o'clock or 8 to 2 o'clock, whatever, 5-6 hours a day, and then it's over. You have all the freedom and you can travel and do it. You can, if you've got self-discipline, you can do it anywhere, which is an incredible advantage to normal school. I don't say that it suits everybody, because I don't think it does, but I think it's a great option to have for the people that want to pursue that way, definitely.
I did an episode of this podcast, Light on Conspiracies, with an incredible woman called Charlotte Thompson Isabit. She was in the education system under the Reagan administration. She was the one of the key people put in charge there to do this thing. And she was quite confused about why she was getting that appointment, because she felt there are so many other people that were more qualified than her. And then once she started working there, there was nothing to do. She was just sitting around picking her nose, not knowing what to, that nobody was, they just said, just be there and that's it. So she got very bored after a few weeks and started just walking around this massive big office, and it was mostly empty, but there were some of these file cabinets left there, and they were packed with documents. And once she started looking into them, she was blown away, because these documents showed the real agenda that had been going on for a long, long, long time. And that agenda was to dumb down the population, totally dumb them down through public education, get drugs involved as soon as possible, as early as possible into the families, destroy the families from inside, get pornography in as soon as possible, get everybody hooked into the internet and so on. And really designing the whole education system into destruction of future generations. She was absolutely shocked, you know. And what she did was she smuggled out a lot of these, if not all of these documents, photocopied them, and later wrote a book, The Dumbing Down of America. But this is through the Bilderberg groups and other groups, the network they have on a global scale, has been put in motion in most Western countries. So what they're very strongly suggesting is get your children out of school, you know, because it is not meant for their good. It is meant for a slow destruction of real education, of real values, because things that are really important for life has been taken out. All spiritual, everything that has mostly been taken out. And instead, so much education has been pumped with useless information that you learn, you do the test, and you forget. What you're doing, I think, is very, very important, because you are sharing life's real school with your children, and how a real alive life can educate you in ways that are way bigger than just normal school. You said, well, we just got a boat and then we went on a three-year around the world sailing trip. I mean, okay. So how did that come about? Was that Craig wanting to get a boat and let's move on?
You know what, there were various reasons why we did this. We traveled a lot in Africa with our kids, and when they were small, we traveled across the world with them all over the place, and we always took them with, because I always felt, you know, I want my kids with me. I didn't give birth to them to leave them behind, and we were very active. I felt that we both discussed that before the kids fly out of home, we want to do something really big with them, like a real big trip, a big adventure as a family, you know. And I had my ideas of maybe getting like a van and travel across Africa for like maybe a year or two and whatever. Now that didn't sound as exotic to my husband, because we were already in Africa. We'd been already so many times into Africa that for me it was like, I love Africa, so for me it was great. But he had always had a dream of sailing and never realized it. I'm not a sailor. I mean, I am now, but I wasn't then. And for me, being at sea for like a long time didn't really appeal to me. When we discussed it back and forth, we were like, well, you know, I'm willing to look at it, because we got to do it. It's got to happen now. Within the next year or two, we actually got to get up and go. Otherwise, it can be too late. one of the kids will fly off, and then it's not the same, you know, then the family is split. Going back and forth and starting to look at boats and whatever, and decided, okay, well, we'll give the sailing a shot. We'll see how it is. So we said we'll give it between 1 and 3 years. We were very privileged to be able to do that because we were running our business and I was independent and we had a partner in our business that we could trust, you know, so it was a good setup, but it's not a setup that just happens in a day. It's something that you plan over time. You must know for a long time that that's what you want to do, and then you steer your steps in that direction, and eventually your setup is like that you can go. Because when I met Craig, he said, let's just sell everything and buy a boat and sail around the world. And I was like, I don't think so. I don't feel like that, you know. I've just moved across the world and I said, I don't feel like selling whatever we got and live in a little sailboat somewhere bobbing around. I said, I'm not going to do that. So when the time was right, we had a home we could rent out. We had a business that would support us. So, you know, it was planning. It was many years of real putting that into motion from the beginning, that something was going to happen. Yeah, once we came to that stage, we took the kids out of school, we bought the boat, and we started sailing, and we didn't know whether we were going to like it. So first half a year was a bit of adjustment, I can tell you, like living on a boat, five of us, and who's gonna be the captain. Craig wanted to be the captain, I wanted to be the captain. I didn't know much about sailing, but I don't like to be told what to do, so that's why I wanted to be the captain. Anyway, we eventually worked our differences out, and it turned out to be an amazing, amazing adventure. It's probably the most fun thing I've ever done in my life. It takes you places. You live in a beautiful home, and it takes you places for free, more or less. I mean, you sail. And I mean, it's not for free to sail because you need maintenance on the boat and stuff. But the fact that you're traveling almost for free and that you can change your backyard whenever you feel like it. And if you don't like your neighbors, you can just move to another bay and you have new neighbors. And it's a very, because I like adventure and because I like what I don't know, I always want to see what's around the next corner. Sailing was amazing for me because you never know what's going to happen the next day and where you're going to be and what it's going to look like. And coming to new places all the time and experiences, new people, new cultures, new food, it was just amazing. It was like living in an adventure book, but you were actually there. It was extremely exciting and very, very nice. And you make incredible friends. It's not a lonely life at all. There are very few people that live that kind of life. And when you realize that when you start crossing the Pacific, there's about 300 sailboats a year that actually cross the Pacific, which is very few. Can you imagine? That's just tiny, tiny portion of the world's population that do that. And there is a special route. You have to follow certain winds and stuff. You can't really go that way or that way because the winds don't allow you to. So you go, you follow the winds and you go specific routes and you end up meeting up with people you saw a few months ago. And so you get to know a lot of people and it's amazing. And you become friends instantly because there's no time to wait for 3 years until you invite your neighbor. You invite them the same night. And it's really a wonderful way of living, very spontaneous, very happy, very unpredictable. You know, you can't predict anything, which is wonderful if you like that kind of thing. I mean, not everybody likes that either, but I do. So my whole family, we really enjoyed it. We really did. And you know, one of the highlights in the Pacific for me was to come to Galapagos Islands and all these incredible creatures that are indigenous to the Galapagos and the non-fear from the animals of humans because they're not threatened. You know, an animal that's never been threatened by humans don't have a fear for humans because there is no reason to. Some people have the feeling that, yeah, but wild animals should be afraid of people, but why should they? If they've never, if you look at the Garden of Eden, I guess we weren't meant to be afraid of anything, you know. And that's how it feels in Galapagos because the animals are right there all around you. And it's an incredible harmony between people and animals. Very, very nice and very protected and a beautiful time and beautiful space to be.
So how did the boys react when you were talking about this trip? Did all three of them want to go?
Yeah, I think they were all quite excited actually about going. There were ups and downs during the trip. I mean, Wilder, my youngest one, I think he, because he's like 2.5 years younger than the others, he couldn't do everything that they did, you know, when we were sailing, because they were kind of around 17, 18, and they could socialize and go off to some other boats and stuff, where Wilder was a little bit too young to tag along because he was still a kid in many ways. And he missed his friends at home because there aren't many teenagers that are out and about on the boats. It's mostly families with young kids or people that have had the kids fly out of home already. So we were quite unusual taking our teenage kids with us and go sailing. I don't think we met any other boats with teenage kids on. So my older boys, they socialized with yachties that were a little bit older than them, you know, like in their 20s and things. And there weren't that many for Wilder. So for him, it was a bit different. But he enjoyed it. But he was probably the one that missed home the most.
Did you learn a lot about yourself being like in this small space with five other or four other individuals, like 24/7?
You know what I learned, which was really interesting, because it wasn't so much about learning about myself. I don't have a problem having my kids and my family really close by. I love it, in fact. I wish they would always be in the next room. But what I did have a problem with the first months was I felt very confined to the boat. Having had a house with a garden and a place where you could just walk out the street, take your car and go, which is a kind of freedom, I felt very confined. I thought, I can't go anywhere. I'm like stuck on this floating little island everywhere. Until I changed outlook on that. I had to change my personal outlook on that and realize that every place I come is my backyard and I'm free to go anywhere. It's just that I have sometimes to get wet to do that, or to get into the dinghy and go to shore as opposed to getting into the car and go somewhere. And it was a different mindset. And when I changed that mindset, the freedom that I felt was incredible. It was almost from one day to the next. It was just about managing the boats and you know, getting into a dinghy and going into a strange island where you've never been before and meeting people. You don't know what to expect. It was taking the next step and being a little bit more brave, you know, and sometimes putting your stuff into a bag and tying it up and swimming to shore just to be able to go into the backyard, you know, to my backyard. And I really enjoyed that once I discovered that my world isn't confined. It was only in my mind that it was confined. And that was a beautiful feeling. And that made me grow. I loved it after that. After that, I really felt like, wow.
Don't you think that is a massive lesson that you learned there, that it is your mind that keeps you trapped? I mean, I see that even with people that are put in prison and so on. Some are put in jail and they're locked in. Some are put in a solitary space where they're free. Their body is locked in, but they're free in their mind. And the change is just so dramatic.
Mm. I agree with you. It's all in your mind. And it's amazing how your mindset will change your outlook on life completely. Because I thought, you know, I'm a land person. I like being on land. I like solid ground. And I will never adjust to being a sailor or living at sea. But you know, once I switched over and realized that I can be anywhere and I can enjoy anything that I see and everything is my backyard. And then I really, really enjoyed everything tremendously, so much more. It's been very good. It was a very good lesson for me because now I can say I'm a sailor and I'm a land person. You know, I'm both. I'm everything. I'm not confined anymore. I would be very restrictive in saying confining things. Now, I don't want to do that or I can't do that or, you know, I think I take a little bit more time now before I say I don't want to do that or I can't do that or, you know, because you just don't know until you've tried it.
We've been having the same type of conversation about sailing for years and I feel just like you felt. For me, it feels like you get out on sea, it's just water, 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 water. What is there to see? And so it's for me to hear these things, because also I'm not a sailor, neither is Kim, so we have absolutely no idea what we're doing. But the dream has been there for Kim to do these long sailings. How did you find these open spaces, but water-wise? Is that something to get used to? Or?
You know, that's a very interesting question, because when we started sailing, I said, well, I won't cross the Pacific. You take the boat, you cross, I'll fly. I'll meet you one of the islands. Because I just couldn't imagine myself sitting out there bobbing for weeks and see nothing. It just seemed like a very waste of time when you can do other things, and nothing to do and nothing to look at. But when it came to that time, that was our third year of sailing, this time to cross the Pacific, and I was the one that was keen to cross now. Craig said, are you sure you want to cross the Pacific? And I said, are you kidding me? We've got to cross the Pacific. And he was like, I don't know. And I said, no, you're the one that always wanted to cross. I said, no, we must cross. And eventually we got out there, and I tell you what, it was a feeling of space. It was incredible to just be out there. And we were sailing fast with a great crew of my boys on the boat. We were trimming our sails all the time and like flying across the ocean like there was no tomorrow. And we crossed the Pacific. We crossed from Galapagos to the Marquesas Island, which is French Polynesia, in 17 days, which is very quick. And normally it will take you between 20 and 30 days. And I was like, I was almost disappointed when we arrived to Marquesas. Are we already here? You know, because I was really enjoying that being out there. And it wasn't, you aren't alone. I mean, you see sea creatures all the time. And the dolphins, they come at night and they swim next to the boat when you sit up there and you do your night shift. And the stars are like, you can pick them down from the sky. And there is no light from anywhere else. So the stars are incredible. And you have this fluorescent microorganisms in the water. And when the dolphins come up to the boat and they swim next to the boat, they're fluorescent. It's just mind-blowing. You think that is not real. And you come across whales, manta rays, everything. And it's just incredible. It's a beautiful life out there. And I will do the crossing anytime. And from saying that I will never do it to I will do it anytime, it's quite a change.
How good a sailor do you think you need to be to start on a journey like this?
You need to be a reasonably good sailor to do a crossing like that, and to be out on the big ocean. You need to be able to read the ocean well and to have experience, I would say. So you don't start by crossing the Pacific. You start by sailing perhaps the Caribbean, you know, for a year or two, learning how to, it's not easy sailing because it can be very, very windy and very rough, but at least the sails are short. You know, it's half a day or a day or a few hours. So there is always somewhere to go. And there's a big community of people sailing. You make friends, you learn a lot. Obviously, before you buy your sailboat, or once you bought your sailboat, you take a course. You take a sailing course so that you know how to skipper a boat, and both of you, you know, learn how to skipper a boat and how to handle things. You learn how to read the weather. And then experience you will know when you're ready to sail, because you know how to then pull the sails and do this and read the weather and read all the machinery on the boat. And so then you're ready. It can be quick and it can take a couple of years, but I wouldn't say go across the world first time around, you know, just start easy. Sail in the Med for a year. Buy a boat and sail. You need to start sailing. You know, you need to actually buy the boat.
Was Greg a good sailor before you started?
He wasn't a good sailor, but he was an extremely good seaman. He's worked at sea all his life. He reads the sea like he reads his own palm. You know, he's very good with reading weather patterns and making decisions of what's going to happen, and kind of having a knowing of the sea and the environment, which is really important, reading the waves and the sea. So I felt very, very safe, because like I said, that's not my forte. You know, it still isn't. I'm much better at it now, of course, but I don't think I will ever be able to compare myself with the life experience of having been at sea like he has, you know, because he's been at sea since he was a child. But you know what, most people don't have that kind of experience, but most people have got an interest for the sea and spend time at the sea, with the sea, doing things with the sea.
Tell me about fear and how you deal with it.
I don't really have much fear in general. I very seldom feel fear. I don't know if I'm born without that natural fear, but I feel very confident and calm inside myself. And I think the times that I have felt fear has been for people, scary people that I've come across, but I very seldom feel fear in general. Anticipation, yes, of course. I think knowledge is a very good key to dealing with the unknown. The more you know about something, the less scary it is. So if you have a fear for something, I would say that the best thing is to learn more about it, and then it will dissolve. A lot of your fears will dissolve.
Can you advise people who are ruled by fear?
You know, we're all very different. I don't know how I would advise somebody that is a very fearful person. You know, you have to work a lot on finding your inner core, who you really are, finding out why do you feel fear in the first place? Why are you fearful? Is it something that is unreasonable from your childhood that has happened? Is your fear justified? Do you live in a war zone where you have bombs maybe coming down next to you? And I don't know, it can be so many different reasons why people have fear, but you need to obviously establish what is your fear and why are you feeling it, and is it justified or reasonable in the first place? If you realize that your fear is unjustified, that it's just there, you know, people have fear for all sorts of things, spiders or, you know, crazy fears, that I think you need to once again go back to yourself. Why do I feel it? What is it with the situation or with this animal or whatever it is that makes me feel like that? And then take in knowledge, really start reading about it, learning about it, become friends with it, with your fear. And I think without you realizing it, it will slowly dissolve because you shed light on it. Fear is darkness. Fear is where you're facing the unknown, where you don't know. And I think once you shed light on it, it dissolves in a very natural way.
I think it's really interesting with fear also that it's only connected with the future, something that is could happen, or you can't be fearful of anything that has happened. It is all the time the future, and it's mm-hmm. almost like the mindset, I would say the same type of mindset, but if you go into the past, that is what connects you with depression, but fear is connected to future. So the more you can stay in the present and inform yourself, the easier it is to deal with these things.
Absolutely, but fear can grip people and it can be very debilitating, of course. But I think, you know, if you have something like that, then you really need to deal with it. You need to find out why. I think it's the source of it, the source of your fear is obviously a beginning, and then try to deal with it in various ways. Talk about it is good. And once again, learn about the things that makes you feel fearful.
If I say life rewards courage, what do you say?
I would say definitely. Life always rewards courage.
Yay, baby.
Courage is a very, very valuable resource to have, because without courage, you will go nowhere. You need to take that next step. You need to have that courage to take the next step. Courage is one of the most valuable qualities I think you can have if you want to be happy.
It was an extreme joy for me to introduce you to my friend Conny Andersson in Sweden, the Apache tracker, who's also, he's a former police officer. He's been on this podcast as well, but he's also an incredible animal lover and is fighting for the survival of the Swedish wolves in specific and against the big hunting cartels in Sweden and abroad as well. Could you tell us a little bit about how that new relationship, what that has meant for you?
Yes, I was very happy that you introduced me to Conny. He's a very, very interesting person, very interesting and very brave. And he sits with a lot of courage and a lot of knowledge that he has subsequently shared with me as we've been getting to know each other. And I went on a tracker course with him, which I found fascinating. He's a very good tracker. And using tracking for me is vital when I'm out photographing the animals in Africa, for instance. So I can use a lot of the knowledge that he's taught me so far. But he's also shown me what I didn't know about Sweden, because I come here on holiday. I haven't lived in Sweden for many, many years, and I was not actually aware of the dire situation of the Swedish ecosystem and how it's really being abused. And, you know, the animal situation of predators are being threatened. And like you say, the hunting community is extremely powerful here. And I'm realizing that the more I investigate, which I've taken now a personal interest in the wolves and the bears and the cats, you know, the lynxes. And I find there's a lot to be done in Sweden to create awareness here and to make people look at it from a different perspective, because I think the wool has been pulled over people's eyes in Sweden very much when it comes to the predator situation and what they do and what they don't do. You know, and at the moment, Sweden has got a population of, I think, maybe 150 wolves, which is a crazy situation. We should have several thousand wolves here in this country to create a natural balance, a self-regulating eco-balance here, where the predators are taking out their prey and balancing nature, as opposed to having 150 wolves and a huge hunting community shooting the moose and the deer and whatever else we have unnecessarily, and creating an imbalance where now all populations of our animals have got issues now. The wolves are too small. The gene pool is too small. 150 wolves cannot survive on a gene pool like that. So if they are to survive, then we need to introduce a lot more wolves to create a better gene pool. The moose have got a problem. Their skeletal system is weak now because they've taken out all the good moose over the years, and the hunting is just fierce. So it's a big problem, and this is obviously something that I've discussed a lot with Connie, because he's involved and he knows a lot about it. And I'm hoping that I can get more involved in Sweden, and I want to start some serious awareness programs here to change public awareness and opinion, which I have been part of doing before with also an hated animal, the great white shark. And I think it can be done here. It's a big job, and it's nothing that happens overnight, but with the right attitude and the right people behind you, you will gain support, and it will create a movement, which is absolutely necessary, I think.
One thing I saw in South Africa was that there was this specific type of dog, a very, very big dog race, that is being used or used to be used to protect livestock and sheep and so on from cheetahs and leopards and so on.
That's
and
right.
I thought that was a brilliant idea, because the problem in Sweden is, at least the official version, is that the reason why the wolves and so on, the predators, need to be on a very small scale is because of the attacks on livestock and so on. So possibly by introducing this type of dog in Sweden, that could solve a lot of these problems in a very peaceful way.
Look, I think that is definitely an aspect that should be looked at, and that is used in many other countries successfully. There are several types of dogs that can be used with different character traits depending on what you want them for. They're not family dogs, most of them, but some of them are less than others. So it depends on your needs and the size of or how many sheep or whatever it is that you want to protect. But it's definitely an option that Sweden should look at, which I think today the problem is that Swedes have got so used to not having enough predators and just feeling that we shouldn't have to be afraid of anything anywhere. We shouldn't have to worry about stuff, and subsequently not actually taking responsibility for their animals. I mean, in many places you use, like let's say that you have a big herd of sheep. At night, you can have a night pen that is electrified. You don't have to electrify all your fields, because now you're talking huge money and big efforts. You can have herding dogs, and you can have night pens where the sheep are kept at night, which is quite a simple solution that is very affordable. And the government here also supports people that want to build things and protect their animals. It's just, I think, a general laziness and unwillingness to take responsibility. I think that is what's stopping people from doing that. And the other aspect is that it's not only the livestock that is the problem here. I think the hunters in this country want to shoot as many animals as possible, because it's also money and it's become fun. A lot of hunters, you can get a hunting license in 3 days in Sweden, then you can just go out and shoot animals and whatever else. And it seems like a crazy situation, you know, where instead of having wolves or other predators regulating the nature, you would have a lot less to shoot. So I think there is a general feeling amongst the hunters that they don't want the predators because they want to shoot as many as possible of the other animals, which won't be possible if you have a big predatory population. I think it's an attitude and the big problem, as I've realized here, is that so many Swedes are hunters and so many of are people in the government or in positions that are sitting in nature conservation and everything. They are hunters. They don't look at it from a perspective of what is actually best for our nature. They're looking at it from a personal perspective of what they want. And I mean, just very recently, I was shocked, really, because the new chairman of the hunting organization in Sweden openly went out in an interview and said, okay, well, if we have a choice between zero wolves and 150 wolves, we choose zero wolves. How can the chairman from a hunting organization that's supposed to practice conservation, is what they call it, say something like that and get away with it? Nobody has raised an eyebrow about it. Well, I did, but in general, I mean, it's like people are very blasé about it.
But I think that was a Freudian slip. You know, because when you look into these organizations, you're looking into a mafia, big time mafia, and it goes on to the highest levels in government and in society as well. And these are the things when, I mean, this program is called Light on Conspiracies. These conspiracies, they have an extreme tendency to always lead back to the same power structure, the same individuals, doesn't matter whatever you're looking into. And I believe that we're looking into the exact same thing here once again. The moose hunt in Sweden is for many people like one of the highlights of the year when they take a week off from work and they sit. It's a very courageous way of hunting. I mean, they put out a salt stone in an open area where there's no coverage at all. They put up these big towers where they can sit with a thermos and hot coffee and just wait for these animals to come out and lick these salt stones as they do the rest of the year. So it takes a lot of courage, a lot of bravery to shoot these innocent animals, and I think it's absolutely disgusting. When I was a kid, one of the things I did was I went around and I pulled out the nails of these from where they knocked. So they, when they started to go up into them, they just fell over. And it almost started like a neighbor issue big time. Or I moved the salt stones into the forest so that they wouldn't be out in these open areas. And there you go. I mean, come on. And also we tried to do everything to get the mooses in on our ground, you know, in our area where they were not allowed to be shot. But it's like, what is that? I mean, really, what is that? And then you say, yeah, but there's so many. Well, why are there so many? Because there you have destroyed the balance. Nature will show you how it's done. So just leave her alone and see, as long as we step back and stop messing with it or her, everything will get back in working order and absolute beauty and harmony. I must say with Conny, if you believe in reincarnation, have you ever seen a reincarnated wolf before? I mean, a kind wolf, but this man with this incredible smile and his whole way of moving, his way of seeing, his way of, I mean, that guy is better than a tracking dog, a sniffing dog. I tell you that he is incredible also because he goes in on a spiritual level. So it's not only tracking to see, oh, there's a fox has passed here a few days ago. Absolutely not. This guy is sharp. I love being around with him because it's just like the things I'm into and trying to expose. I mean, we're both into exposing criminals and destructive forces that are just trying to mess us up. And so when the two of us come together, it's like fireworks. It's amazing because, you know, I'm sitting talking about one thing and things just comes to him. And it just, whoop, he just, and I say, why did you say that? He said, I have no idea. He just, and there it is. And then it has given me some incredible new angles. He's doesn't know where it comes from either. You know, it's just that he's so open. So I can very much recommend his courses. They're called trackerschool.se, because it's so much more than just tracking. It's a matter of getting in harmony with yourself and nature and your inner being in balance, and treat everything with respect and so on.
I agree with you. I mean, I brought my two bigger sons to join me on one of Connie's tracker courses, like I said. And it's a lot more than just tracking the actual tracks on the ground. It's about awareness of what's happening around you, very much so, to broaden your horizons on a very sensitive level, where you sense things and you feel things and you pick up the energies, you pick up the vibrations, you pick up a lot of stuff. He's a very, very good teacher as well, and I would recommend anybody to go on a course like that, because it's really an eye-opener. Whether you're interested in tracking in nature or tracking in the city, it's all about awareness of what's around you, and to start taking in details and becoming aware of everything. It's something you can use in daily life. Absolutely. And yes, I think he is a wolf incarnated, reincarnated. I really do think so.
Oh, yeah. I'm just waiting for him to sit howling outside our house one day. I really want somebody to hear here, you know. One thing that I just want to tell about him was that he was used as a tracker when he was a police officer as well. And there was sometimes when maybe a robber had escaped, and he was hiding in a big industrial building, and they couldn't find him. So when Connie came there, he just asked everybody to leave. And what he did was he went in there. It was this big, big, big place, you know, lots of places to hide and so on. He just went in there, turned off the light, and just stood waiting. And he waited for about 20, 25 minutes, and then suddenly the guy started moving around. And so he heard him, and just there he is. You know, so often it's a matter of also stepping back and just breathe, be in peace, be in calm, calmness and balance, and just, and there it is. The thing to see what is, but not what also isn't. No, it's just, it's very, very fascinating. So you tell us about one of the best encounters you had with an animal.
Some of my most powerful encounters, I think, has been with the gorillas up in Uganda. Very, very powerful and very emotional. Meeting with them on a spiritual level, where they so strongly communicate emotion to us, and acceptance of us being in their presence, it was probably one of the most greatest moments ever. If you have the opportunity to do it, I mean, there are only 800 mountain gorillas left in the world, and they are very, very threatened, and they live in small, small area. I mean, if you consider it, it seems big when you're there, but in the bigger scheme of things, it's very, very small, and they don't have anywhere else to go, because it's all developed land around the Virunga Mountains and the Biwindi impenetrable forest. There is no more space for them to expand because it's all been populated. I think it's very important to keep those gorillas alive and protected, and it's a very dangerous zone. The rangers often get murdered in the process of protecting them. Recently, there was a few rangers that got murdered by poachers, and sometimes it is the guerrilla. You know, there's war on the Congo side, the DRC. It's a difficult area to protect because it's very wild and it's difficult to penetrate. And the gorillas move around all over the place all the time. They move over big distances to feed. So it's difficult to control the environment in which they're in. Yeah, I think that was probably one of the most powerful meetings I've had. It was really the first time when I went to visit the gorillas in Uganda. It was very emotional.
How close did you get to them?
I was probably from the silverback, I would say about 4 meters.
Wow.
I was with a very, very good tracker. he spoke the language that they spoke, you know. He rumbled and sounded. He made all sorts of incredible sounds, this man. And they were doing it back to him. So they were actually talking verbally with each other, whereas I talk energetically. This tracker was just incredible when he was communicating with them in their own special language. And it was fantastic. They felt safe with us being there. And I looked at this big silverback. He was lying like this with huge shoulders. And he looked at me. I have a photograph. It's actually in the book, I think. And he's looking at me. You see his eye whites. And he looks almost human. And his virility and strength, it was just incredible. And I thought to myself, oh, my God. I think I'm going to go home and divorce my husband and just marry this guy instead because he's too gorgeous. It was almost like love, you know. It was incredible, that feeling. And he was there with his females and all the babies and that total and utter love that they have for each other. And he's this protector. And as long as he feels safe, you can be there. The moment you would threaten or he would feel threatened, he could kill you in a heartbeat. But they are probably the most gentle giants of this earth. They are very, very gentle and very kind, you know. They are incredible creatures. And very wise. Incredible.
You know, that is one of my favorite words, gentle giant. I think that is just so beautiful.
Well, I mean, the elephant is another very gentle giant that if they feel safe with you, they are incredible creatures. Obviously, they feel threatened and they will attack. Like anything, I mean, so will we. You know, when we are threatened, we will also attack and fight for the ones we love and for ourselves and for our own lives. So there are no aggressive animals, actually. No animals are aggressive in my eyes. They're only aggressive when they are put in a situation where aggression is required.
Is a lion aggressive when it's hunting?
It's an explosive power. It's not aggression. You know, they can be aggressive in between themselves, you know, when it comes to hierarchy or taking over a pride, then you're talking aggression. But they're not aggressive when they hunt. It's an explosive energy of survival. And I wouldn't call that aggression.
Jutta, it's been an absolute wonderful pleasure to speak to you. And I hope that you have inspired a lot of people to find their own true self and their path in life. Absolutely beautiful, beautiful book. We have it on our table here in our living room at all times. It's a fantastic book. Could you once again please tell our viewers and listeners how they can contact you, how they can support you in what you want to achieve, how they can help when it comes to supporting animal freedom and equality balance?
To contact me, the best way to do that is through my email, most likely, and that is visionaliveimages@gmail.com. The other one is to go into my website. It's www.visionaliveimages.com. When it comes to supporting what I do or sharing with me what I do, you can also join me on a trip into Africa, where we do wildlife photography and animal communication as a part of it. And we do tracking, which is really interesting. So you will get like a full experience and a great understanding, and your photographs will be different from, we can show you that when you actually take your time and communicate with the animals and have a response and an acceptance, your pictures will come out very different from if you just take a photograph. That's one way that you can join and come and really learn something new. I think if you are not interested in going into Africa or doing things like that, support different projects. Do your research. Find things that you're passionate about and support them. Support them with your time. Support them with petitions. Support them with your money if you've got any. Even if you don't have, I think you still should support. You should do your share, because we are all sharing this earth. And it is all our responsibility to protect it. A lot of these organizations are fighting for you, for your world to survive. And it is not their responsibility. It is actually your responsibility to make sure that that continues. And I think we need to take a bigger look at what are we doing ourselves to protect our world? How do we live our lives? What do we eat? What do? What do we stand for? And be brave. Stand up for what you believe. And really, if you believe something strongly, then don't be afraid to say it. Do it. Say it. And be proud of it.
Beautiful ending words. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ola. It was lovely talking to you.
Thank you so much for listening to Light on Conspiracies, the place where truth and love transcend the darkness. Take care and see you soon.
May the entire universe be filled with peace and joy, love and light. May everyone, and especially the ones who heard us, be filled with peace and joy, love and light. Victory to that light.
coup d'etat in slow motion, connecting the dots between the assassinations of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, JFK, Robert Kennedy, and John Lennon. Now available on Amazon and lightonconspiracies.com. Coup d'etat in slow motion.